Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You ever hear that old joke about the inauguration of the first ever Jewish female president? Here's Brenda Fishman to fill you in.
And seated right in the front row, front and center, was her widowed mother. Proud as could be, she sat and watched, and just as her daughter, the president-elect, was about to step up onto the dais to become sworn in, she turned to the senior senator and said, "Do you see that young woman? Her brother's a doctor."
Studying medicine requires intelligence and discipline and considerable expense, making it a prestigious profession across America's religious and ethnic stratum. That wasn't always true. Bess Lovejoy wrote about one of the first major riots in the post-revolution United States, caused by popular anger against doctors. Her story of the so-called Doctors' Riot, which took place in New York City in April of 1788, is featured on Smithsonian.com. Bess, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, we hold doctors in such high esteem now, knowing they've been through so much schooling, that may be part of the reason. Not always the case. What did an aspiring physician in the late 18th century need to do in order to learn their practice?
Well, it really varied from place to place, but most of the licensing rules didn't come into place until pretty late in the century or in the early 20th century. And so a lot of the time you would just do some private training with another physician, and often that was enough to allow you to go and hang out your shingle, particularly in a small town, and say you were a doctor. So the whole process of going to medical school and getting licensed and all of that wasn't really in place the way we think of it today in the era after the Revolutionary War. Things were just much too tumultuous.
But dissections were a pretty necessary part of the experience, from what I understand.
Yeah, certainly. Well, if you're going to be operating on somebody, you hope to have some training beforehand. And, of course, today doctors are increasingly able to use digital means to practice dissection. They still dissect human beings, but there's a move towards doing it digitally and using even synthetic cadavers now. But back in the old days, really the only way to practice was on a cadaver. And so dissection was considered a pretty important part of medical training, particularly if you wanted to be, you know, good at what you were doing.
What was the attitude toward operating on cadavers at the time?
Pretty negative, pretty suspicious. I mean, this is one of the attitude changes that I think is really interesting. Until relatively recently, people thought of messing with the body after death as violating the sanctity of the dead bodies. There were also some Christians, and this varied, but there was a certain attitude towards this idea that if you were dissected after death, you might not be resurrected. And there was the other problem here is that because nobody was donating their body to science, the supply of cadavers was generally coming from graveyards. So often the legal supply of cadavers would just be a handful of executed criminals, and that was the case in both England and America. But there were far more doctors who wanted to practice on cadavers than there was supply of cadavers. So frequently, you know, the doctors and the medical students, and then sometimes also thieves that they would hire, would be going into the cemeteries and digging up bodies for dissection. Mm. And that was another thing that people really objected to.
And I read in your article that it was the African-American graveyards that were especially being disinterred in order to provide cadavers. And a group of African-Americans, both free and enslaved at the time, did petition the government about this. So tell us more about that phenomenon and their complaint.
Sure. Well, yeah, there was what was known at the time as the Negroes' Burial Ground, which was established just outside of the city of New York City's city limits, right next to a pauper's graveyard. And the medical students would rob both of those graveyards for bodies. But what ended up happening is that the cadavers they were dissecting were disproportionately black. And, I mean, that it was for the reason that you might imagine, which is just wholesale racism. Black bodies weren't given the same... They weren't thought of as being fully human in the same way that white bodies were. And so there was actually a petition. I can't remember the number of free and enslaved black people who lodged this petition with New York City City Council in, I believe it was February 1788, but they complained. And it's interesting because they actually didn't just complain about the dissection and the robbery of the graves for the dissection, but they actually complained about how it was done. I think they said something about bodies being dragged away in wanton sallies of excess and entrails being spread around for animals. So they kind of said, you know, we understand that dissection needs to happen, but can you at least do it in a more orderly way? And the petition was entirely ignored. But what happened to kind of change things is that then there was a report of the body of a white woman being stolen from Trinity Churchyard a couple months after the petition from the blacks of New York. And that's when the popular resentment really started to boil over.
Yeah, tell us what happened. That seemed to have been the boiling point. That was in February 1788, that the body of a white woman had been stolen. That really changed the game. And what happened?
Well, there's conflicting accounts of how the riot started. No one is exactly sure, but it seems that there were some small boys who were playing in the grass outside of New York Hospital, and that was one of the places where these kind of private lectures and dissections were taking place. And basically the boys saw something that really upset them. Either they climbed up and saw a body being dissected, or they saw sort of a withered arm being hung out the window to dry. And in one version of the story that gets repeated a lot of the time, one of the boys saw an arm being waved out the window by one of the medical students. And keep in mind, the medical students were probably boys who were only about 17 or 18. And so they're kind of messing with boys who are about 11 or 12. So one of these medical students is supposed to have said, "This is your mother's arm. I just dug it up." And the boy, you know, horrified, climbs down the ladder and runs to his father, who's a mason, working with a bunch of men on a building site sort of further down Broadway. And he tells his dad what happened. And his dad is concerned because, in fact, the boy's mother had just recently died. And so they go to the graveyard, exhume the coffin, and they do find the boy's mother's coffin empty. And so the father is very upset, and he gathers all of his other friends, all these other masons, and they're still carrying all their tools, their picks and their shovels and everything, and they march on New York Hospital and proceed to start tearing it apart. And that's pretty much how the riot starts.
Dun, dun, dun. I'm talking with Bess Lovejoy, who wrote about the gory New York City riot that shaped American medicine. That's the name of her article for Smithsonian.com. You feature some quotes in the article about the start of the riot, including one from Colonel William Heth. "The cry of barbarity was soon spread." So this started running amok all over town. It sounds pretty gruesome. What happened?
It was pretty gruesome, and like I said, there's conflicting accounts, but it sounds like when this mob of masons and other workers got to the hospital, they started taking out all of the pathological specimens, many of which had been imported from Europe. They'd start dragging them into the streets and setting them afire, and most of the medical students flee, although a couple of them try to stay to protect the specimens. They find some bodies that are being dissected in another room. They drag those to the bonfire also. And then what happens is, I think finally the mayor comes down and he escorts the remaining medical students off to jail for their own protection because he's worried that they're going to get dragged into the bonfire too. And the mob rages for a while and they burn things and destroy things. Things settle down overnight, but then in the morning, another mob goes and basically starts searching the entire city for cadavers in the midst of being dissected. So they search doctors' houses. They search Columbia. Alexander Hamilton is actually on the steps of Columbia trying to defend the school against the mob, and he actually gets kind of roughed up. I think he's knocked down, and he's not able to work for a couple of days because of it. And they don't find anything at Columbia, and in fact, they don't really find anything else in the city because as word of the mob has spread, the medical students and doctors have kind of carefully hidden anything that might be found. But the mob gets really upset. They go around the city, continue looking, and then finally they go to the jail where a couple of the medical students are being held, and they attack it. And then the militia comes out, and then more militia men come out, and people are fighting with bricks and bayonets and stones. And there's conflicting accounts of how many injuries and deaths there were, but somewhere between 3 and 20 people died. you know, and there's reports of blood staining the pavement and all of that. So it was pretty bloody, and it lasted for a few days until the militia was able to kind of settle things down.
Wow. Well, so what were some of the more immediate effects of the riots on doctors and their practices, both conventional and educational?
Well, the sort of the immediate effect is they stopped advertising. They pulled all of their ads from the papers, and then several doctors published announcements saying, we've never robbed any bodies from the city. And that's interesting because, as I was saying, the so-called Negro burial ground and the Pauper's burial ground were established outside the city. Essentially, these doctors are telling people, well, no, we've never robbed any respectable bodies. It's just, you know, these black bodies. You don't have to worry too much about that. But this is all sort of short-lived because pretty soon things start back up as they were before. And the following year, there's a law passed that tries to regulate the supply of cadavers and establish a legal supply, which was basically just getting them exclusively from executed criminals. But the law is kind of a joke. It doesn't supply as many cadavers as necessary. And so the grave robbing continues, you know, into the 19th century in some parts of the United States. But throughout the 19th century, there's a succession of these anatomy acts, sometimes called bone bills, that try to regulate this and create a legal supply of bodies for dissection so that medical students and doctors aren't robbing graveyards anymore.
One of the most important consequences, though, of these riots relates to how we started this conversation, the training required for doctors. Mm-hmm. What changed as a result?
There was a movement towards more schooling, more test taking, more exams for doctors. But, I mean, the unfortunate thing there is even legitimate medical schools were robbing graveyards. I did another article for the Smithsonian about the medical school in Atlanta that in 1989, when they were renovating the building, they found hundreds and hundreds of bones in the building's basement, and they were primarily from bodies that had been stolen by the kind of in-house so-called resurrection man, which is what they sometimes called thieves employed by the school to rob graveyards. And they actually had an in-house slave who they employed to do this work, and his name was Grandison Harris. So even if you were required to go to school, take exams, you might still very well be getting your bodies completely extra-legally, let's say.
Well, best love, Joy, resurrecting a little bit of unknown history for us. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Best Lovejoy is author of Rest in Pieces, The Curious Fates of Famous Corpses. She's speaking with us today about her article for Smithsonian.com. It's called The Gory New York Riots That Shaped American Medicine. You can read the article yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up on Word of Mouth, we'll continue our exploration of the human body, but we're going to say for this next segment, no staring. We'll take a trip to a nudist resort with a first-time nudist to learn the protocols and where exactly you should be looking. That's after the break. Please stay with us for that.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. This summer, VH1 debuted its newest reality show, Dating Naked.
I feel embarrassed because I'm putting myself out there, like my whole self, like everything is right there in front of this guy that I don't know.
You're like, hey, you're naked, I'm naked. I didn't even get to buy you a drink yet.
I know.
Nudity seems to be the latest trend in reality TV. The Discovery Channel show Naked and Afraid sends two naked strangers into the wilderness to fend for themselves. And TLC has a real estate show called Buying Naked, where couples search for their dream home in the nude. And while nudity is generally more socially accepted in European countries, the lifestyle known as nudism or naturism is growing rapidly in the United States. Producer Kion Wolf visited Solaire Family Nudist Resort in Woodstock, Connecticut, to fully experience, for the first time, life as a nudist.
I am parked on the side of the road before getting to Solaire Family Nudist Resort in Woodstock, Connecticut, and I'm feeling excited, a little anxious, so let's just get on with this. I want to get there. Here we go. And this big gate is opening after I ring the doorbell. It says, welcome back for a nude year at Solaire. They crossed out the new and put nude That's my kind of humor. Paul?
Hi, I figured I'd give it a shot right from the start. Nice to meet you.
Good to meet you, too.
I want to bring back my four-wheel, and I got a golf cart. I can take you around in the golf cart. And then
that's beautiful.
You can decide at what point you want to disrobe, if you want to disrobe at all.
Yes, I do. Here.
Okay.
I do. I definitely do.
Okay, did you bring do you have a sarong or something that you want to throw on to start with, or are you just ready to go full boat?
Let's just do it.
All right, let's go down my site. Then you can disrobe down there.
Perfect.
All right, so you'll follow me down.
Now, I got to ask, in terms of etiquette, like right now, I'm making sure that I'm staring at your face.
You can look anywhere you want. We're all nude. You're going to look at people.
That's the point,
I guess. That's the whole thing. It doesn't make a difference.
But I'm like, looking at your eyes.
You do what you want. Until you feel comfortable, you look at my eyes.
How's all right, that? All right. That sounds good. Thanks, Paul.
Okay. How long did it take you to get yourself psyched up to do this?
Here's my thought. I should be as nervous to come here as I would to go to the OBGYN. It's nothing they haven't seen. It's nothing you haven't seen. So mentally, you know, no problem. But there's a part of my brain that's like, never done this before.
If you spent 15 minutes here in clothes, you'd feel uncomfortable.
How do I take my clothes off?
I think you're good at that. You can go inside my trailer, take your clothes off the side. How's that?
Never.
Did you bring a towel?
No, I don't know.
I'll give you a towel.
Thank you.
That's part of the etiquette. You need to sit on a towel.
That makes sense.
Okay.
All right.
We only have two spots in camp that you are absolutely required to be nude. That's on the beach and at the pool. Every place else is clothing optional. We prefer to everybody be nude all the time, but it's your prerogative.
Fair. Yeah.
Okay?
So sit on a towel.
Sit on
Number
a towel.
Number one rule.
Number one.
Number two rule, sit on a towel.
There you go.
All right.
All right.
So just head on in there and...
You go head in there and take your time. I'll wait out here for you.
Thanks all a right. lot. And now I'm naked. Okay. Feel oddly fine. Okay.
All right.
You ready? Huh. So I feel awfully white right now.
Well, yeah,
you're kind of, next
you
to you.
Kind of white.
Yeah, you're super tan. Here we are riding in your golf cart, and there's a nice breeze, and I'm feeling breezes in places that I had never felt breezes before. It's really nice.
It's different, right?
It's different. I like it. I like it.
Well, that's a good thing.
I can see how you get used to this.
I have to congratulate you on how easy it was for you to disrobe.
I've never heard those words before in my life. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
It's been, 5 minutes? I feel great. It's like instantly awesome. And of course it would be different if I were at a grocery store in Manhattan. You know what I mean? But being here and knowing that, hey, we're all on the same level. That is really cool. And you feel it right away.
Yeah.
I like it.
And that's the thing. There's no status here. Everybody's on the same playing field. This guy could be picking up trash and this guy could be a doctor. We don't know.
Except people with awesome tattoos are pretty. We do have something
there's
to offer.
In that, sure.
There's a couple of people here that's got some pretty nice tattoos.
I'm sure I would see.
Yeah.
I told my mom about this, and her pitch went up about 3 octaves, but she said, well, somebody from the station is going to go with you, right? And I'm like, absolutely not. Are you kidding me? No one's coming from the radio station with me here.
And that's the stigma. Single women can't come here by themselves because it's not appropriate, and that's so far from the truth.
That's true. If there's anywhere on the planet that I could take all my clothes off and not in my own home that's safe, it would be here.
Exactly.
And I have to just make a comment right now. My upper body is in shadow. My butt is in the sun. Feels great.
It does.
Feels like I've never had my butt in the sun.
This is the first time she's ever taken her clothes off.
The only way to travel.
Putting your butt in the sun or naked all together?
Naked all together.
Right now, having my butt in the sun is really ridiculously pleasing. It's really nice. Do I have to put my clothes back on? I have to.
Well, you can drive home. You can drive home nude if you want.
But officer, I just came from Solaire.
What do you think a cop's going to say if he stops a woman and she's driving there nude? He's just going to look at you and he's going to go, just go home. Go ahead, go.
And I could experience the breeze. I'm going to think about that.
You already experienced the breeze.
Yeah. But it's funny, as I was putting my clothes back on, I was thinking, you know, in any other circumstance, I'd be afraid someone would walk in on me. Meh.
I did the gentlemanly thing and stayed outside.
Well, yeah. And now here I am standing on your front porch in my bra because...
It's hot.
Because it's hot, and I didn't have to put anything else on, because I'm going to keep my shirt off. Screw that. I'm going to my car. I'm going to keep my bra on. People think it's a bathing suit top.
There you go.
They don't know the difference.
There you go.
Thanks again. Thank you enough.
I'll see you on Tuesday.
Can't wait.
All right, take care.
You too. I have a lot of absorbing to do. It's kind of messing with my head a little bit, in a good way. I felt instantly leveled with everybody there. Paul at one point told me, you know, of all the people you talked to today, two of them are multimillionaires. But, you know, I didn't have time to notice their cufflinks or their designer tie so I could straighten up my posture. I can understand how you could be regularly around people completely naked and just see each other for who you are. In a way, you want to be like, no big deal. And in a way, it's a really big deal. I have a lot to think about. And I'm so driving home in my bra. Oops, there goes my shirt up over my head. Oh my.
And our thanks to producer Kion Wolf for that story. Coming up, some people get a thrill from walking around in the nude. Some people take thrill seeking to a whole other level. We'll hear about the rise of war tourism after the news.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You know, things are getting tense in the country when the U.S. Department of State warns Americans against traveling there. For some intrepid travelers vacationing in failed states, nations at war or in revolt, or those deemed unfriendly to America, is a draw. Whether it's skiing in the Afghan mountains, getting a glimpse of the war in Syria, or being one of the few to get into North Korea, a growing number of adventure travelers find courting danger more enticing than relaxing at an all-inclusive resort. Freelance writer Deborah Kamin profiled the rise of unlikely tourist destinations for the Atlantic. We reached her in between air raid sirens from Israel via Skype. Deborah, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
Well, it's funny. We're speaking to you from Israel, where you have a front row seat to a conflict that the whole world is watching. But even before this violence began, you noticed a growing number of tourists in the Golan Heights in Israel's northern border. What were they coming to see?
They were coming to see the Syrian civil war. And it's very funny because I worked on this piece for several months long before this conflict broke out. And at the time, Israel was touted as this peaceful, wonderful place, and tourists were coming just to watch conflict across the border. So it's interesting how things have changed.
So groups of tourists would go up and look at what was going on, the fighting over what is it called, the gateway to Damascus up there in the Golan Heights. What's the draw for the spectators?
I think the appeal of being as close as possible to a massive world story, but also having total safety. So it's this dichotomy of looking at something that's so dangerous, but where you are protected on the other side of the border, near all these beautiful wineries and apple orchards. It's the combination of the two that people find very enticing and very thrilling. Hmm. And it's a great story for a cocktail party or for your Facebook page when you get home. People love it.
I guess thrill being the operative word here. Yeah. What are some of the other active conflict zones where you found out that adventurous tourists are signing up to visit?
Pretty much anywhere where you can go and come close to blood, there's people who follow. There's people who are going to Ukraine to see what's going on there. There's people who are very interested in going to Afghanistan and sitting in the house of people who may or may not be the Taliban. It's really fascinating how this appeal of being close to the news, but also being curious yourself and discovering the news on your own, is really driving the tourism industry.
Well, war isn't new. How about this war tourism industry?
It's as old as war itself, absolutely. As long as there have been battles, there have been people gathering to watch the battles. You know, we hear stories about Gettysburg and the armies as they were marching were followed by people who wanted to watch. The difference is now that it's actually being commercialized and packaged. That's the real change, that the tourism industry is picking up on this and trying to make a dollar from it.
Why do you think there's such an increase right now? Is it that so many spots are in turmoil?
I think it's a combination of two factors. I think it's the massive infiltration of social media, so everyone feels that they can be a citizen journalist and be close to conflict. And it's also the way the tourism industry itself is changing. It used to be if you wanted to go on vacation, you had to go through an agent, and they were in control of booking your tickets and your hotel. And now people are really in control of their own vacations. They book their own airfare. They choose where they want to go. They can do their own price comparison. And in order to stay competitive, the tourism industry has become more creative. And this is one of the ways we're seeing it happen.
One of the most exotic destinations for adventure tourists is now North Korea. Now, this is a trip that Vice magazine highlighted in its documentary, The Vice Guide to Travel, North Korea. Here's just a clip from the documentary.
So we went out on a night on the town in Pyongyang with our guards, which is good because the guards weren't enjoying us as human beings. Today they threatened Jamie, who's filming this, with... what was it? Gross and sensitive crimes to the Republic or something?
Right. Criminal offenses.
Criminal offense.
Which would have severe repercussions. Yeah.
All we had to do was buy like 6 bottles of blueberry wine and everybody was fine.
You talked a little bit about the attraction. I wonder also about travel programs that have gotten more and more extreme in their depictions of where to go and where to find your thrills.
Absolutely. I really think the two go hand in hand. The more extreme travel programs on TV go, the more extreme the average tourist who watches those programs becomes in their own travel. And North Korea, it's a perfect place for people to want to travel to because it's so off the beaten path. It's so far away from anything we know. And that's also why it makes good TV.
Deborah Kamin is a writer living in Israel, and she profiled a growing number of travel agencies and operators catering to war tourism, the kind of thrill seekers and spectators deliberately vacationing in and around active conflict zones. Well, obviously there's a danger, but how about some of the ethical concerns surrounding war tourism?
It's a great question, and it's the question I brought up with every single operator that I interviewed. They all feel, and it's their own opinion, they feel that one of the best ways to teach people about a broader worldview and actually to improve the ethics of travel is to take people to areas that are off the beaten path, that are not getting travel dollars, that are often misrepresented by the media. So in their mind, they're actually promoting ethical travel at the most intimate level.
But at the same time, profiteering off of witnessing the misery of others.
It's true. It's really, you know, the way you look at it. And when there is misery going on, there's also civilians who've lost out, who are in desperate need of Americans willing to purchase their wares and invite other friends to come and see their where they live. So it really goes both ways. You could argue either side very passionately and very effectively.
Deborah, do you think as the push for more extreme travel experiences to, you know, talk about at the water cooler or cocktail party widens, do you think this trend is going to get bigger?
I absolutely do. It's already getting bigger. It's still, like I said, a very, very small portion of the industry, but the rate at which it's growing is huge. It's almost doubling every year. So when you have something growing that quickly and gaining that much steam, and you also have media programs like Parts Unknown by Anthony Bourdain and Vice, people are going to follow and the money is going to follow.
Deborah Kamin, thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Deborah Kamin is a freelance writer. She's living in Israel. Her article, The Rise of Dark Tourism, was published in The Atlantic. You'll find a link to read it for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. If traveling halfway around the world to witness conflict is not your idea of a great getaway, we have a much safer local option for you, America's Stonehenge in Salem, New Hampshire. It's a classic attraction that has been drawing people for more than 50 years. Word of mouth intern Molly Donahue went to check it out and brings us the story.
Anyone who has been to Stonehenge might find the name America's Stonehenge misleading. The low-slung stone ruins don't look like the famous monoliths of southern England. But this classic New Hampshire attraction is more than meets the eye.
Well, America's Stonehenge, we think, is possibly one of the oldest man-made stone ruins in North America. It has been worked on for about a century, and it's still a mystery as to who built the site, where did they come from, what happened to the people that built the site, and what was the site used for.
Dennis Stone is president of America's Stonehenge in North Salem. He's been involved with the site since the 1950s, when his parents bought the land and opened it to the public. The low stone walls are of dry stone construction, which means no cement was used, and stone tools point towards pre-modern building techniques used by lithic cultures. While parts of the structures only date back to colonial times, artifacts like hammerstones and arrowheads discovered on the site point to a much older history. The most compelling evidence comes from 16 carbon dating tests, the oldest of which comes from a charcoal sample dating back 4,000 years.
The site is quite similar to other sites in New England. There are about 800 sites from Canada through New England and into New York. And many of these, again, are unknown as to what their origin is and who built them.
America's Stonehenge has always been a family affair, but it wasn't always called by that name. When Stone's father first opened the site to the public, it was called Mystery Hill, a legacy that still lives on today.
My dad opened it up as Mystery Hill Caves in 1958. By 1963, they changed it to Mystery Hill. People were thinking we were like a natural caves, like polar caves, which are really neat, but we're more archaeological, although we really do talk a lot about the geology of the hilltop. So they did drop the name Caves, so it became Mystery Hill. This is Mystery Hill, the name of the hill itself. And the name of the business is America's Stonehenge.
England's Stonehenge is a major tourist attraction, drawing up to 5,000 visitors a day. Despite the name, North Salem's more modest ruins don't see nearly that much traffic. But Stone's decision to call the site America's Stonehenge isn't just a business strategy.
Functionally, it's similar to Stonehenge, but the form of it looks different than Stonehenge. But the thing is, we do have the same alignments. We have the lunar alignments, solar alignments, and everything. So Stonehenge, name America Stonehenge, I think is kind of, some people like it, some people don't. I think it's okay. It tells you, you know, it is an astronomically aligned site. So, but Mystery Hill is still here too. And I as far as I know, we'll keep it like that, you know.
So. And as for the other non-human residents of the site?
Yeah, they look a little like they came from Star Wars, you know.
Down the hill from the ruins, in a closed pen, are a group of fuzzy alpacas. They're more family pets than anything else. But just because these fluffy members of staff may do more to delight than educate, doesn't mean they don't pull their own weight.
My son got real interested in them, and my wife wanted to give him some responsibility, you know. And we've had three babies born here. We may have another one. And we saved the fiber. We have a shearer come up from Rhode Island. He shears them. We clean it, send it out to Connecticut or New York.
The diversity of the site has made America's Stonehenge popular amongst shows that look at the mysterious and unknown. It was one of these programs that struck the interest of Brian Behealer, a North Carolinian who made his way up to Salem, New Hampshire, to attend an annual summer solstice ritual that's been held on Mystery Hill for the past 20 years. He drove the nearly 900 miles overnight in order to reach the site.
Hello, I'm Beeb. That's a nickname. My real name is Brian Behealer. I was looking for something to do on the summer solstice, experience the energies and be around people who are looking into the same thing. So when I saw that this was happening today, I knew that I was coming, and so here I am.
America's Stonehenge draws people with all sorts of interests, from the spiritual to the historical, and even some who just want to see some alpacas. Whether or not the supernatural lives on at the site is anyone's guess. It's just another mystery on Mystery Hill. For Word of Mouth, this is Molly Donahue.
For many people, New Orleans is a bucket list destination or a place to return to over and over again. Up next, we're going to head to the Crescent City for a chat with musician Glenn David Andrews. His latest album, Redemption, has been receiving rave reviews from the New York Times to the Wall Street Journal. We're going to talk with him about his music and his long road to sobriety after the break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. For a time, Glenn David Andrews was one of the musicians you just had to see perform if you visited New Orleans. The singer and trombonist song known as Roll With Me was a staple among brass bands. You'd see him playing his horn at funerals and second line parades or leading a rotating crew of musicians at local clubs. After a few unhinged gigs and a lengthening rap sheet over scrapes with the law and drug and alcohol offenses, it looked like Glenn David Andrews was running out of road. Like his storm-ravaged city, he needed help. Glenn found a route to recovery in rehab. It is in that music that he is finding redemption.
Daddy's on the corner, shooting dice. Mama's in the kitchen, making beans and rice. Walk through the river, swim through the flood. Took a feather from a bald head eagle, jump back, woo, drink panther blood. Life is like a mockery.
That's the song From New York to NOLA from the album Redemption. And Glenn David Andrews joins us to talk more about the new album and his new road. Glenn David Andrews, a pleasure to speak with you.
Good morning, sweetheart. How you feeling?
I'm feeling just great. Really happy to talk to you. You grew up in Tremaine, and this is the neighborhood that is kind of a crucible for New Orleans music and that inspired the HBO series called Tremaine. What do you remember first hearing or thinking or seeing music and thinking, that's what I want to do?
I remember watching Olympia Brass Band early as 4 years old, and I knew that I would be a part of the Olympia Brass Band, and I grew up. It was in 1997 when I officially joined the Olympia Brass Band, and that's still one of the oldest brass bands in New Orleans. I watched the original Tuxedo Jazz Band, which is the oldest institution in jazz, and I grew up to be a member of that band, so I've always wanted to be a musician, and I've been lucky enough to only have had one small job in my life. Other than that, I've only played music and traveled, so I knew this is what I was supposed to do.
But tell us a little bit about what got you to Redemption. It sounds like you were sinking downward at the same time that New Orleans, after Katrina, after the flood, was trying to rise out of the muddy water. What got you to rehab?
D-R-U-G-S. Drugs. Well, it gets most people to rehab.
Well, but you've been doing drugs for a while and been coping with it. Why finally decide that it's time?
Well, you know, we all go through stuff, and at one point you get an opportunity to be able to really look at yourself and decide if you want to be something better than what you are. I never thought I was a bad person. I did a lot of very great, successful things in the midst of an addiction. But it gets to a point where you have to put the brakes on. And right now, I think I'm creating the best music I've ever done in my life. I'm more happier than I've ever been in a long time. So it was more than just a bunch of reasons. You know, when you're dealing with addiction, you're dealing with a lot of selfishness. You're becoming real selfish. And you're not looking at the impact that it has on your mother, your sister, your brother, your nieces, your nephews. And today I'm a better son. I always was a cool uncle, but I'm way cooler as an uncle now. My brother, Rebirth Brass Band, we have a great relationship. Me and my sister are best friends. And I'm single and happy. And right now, I wouldn't trade that for all the silver and gold in the world.
You're also a born showman. You know, I've seen you play in small clubs, and also our senior producer saw you at Jazz Fest, put on an amazing show. That requires a kind of bravado, and I think recovery requires a kind of humility. It can't be an easy place, New Orleans, on stage to be sober.
It's never an easy place, but it's an everyday struggle. I'm not perfect by a long shot. I won't sit here and act like I am perfect, but I do understand that where I was at almost two and a half years ago is not where I ever want to be again in my life. But like any other addict or any other person that deals with recovery, it's called one day at a time. And that's the only way I figure that I can deal with it. I don't really know what's going to happen tomorrow, but I know just for the day and just for right now, I'm happy, I'm sober, and I'm going to the bodega and buy tennis after this. So I don't really have much to complain about. Just one day at a time. And I didn't get here by myself. It was a real host of people that really loved me for who I am, not what I am.
Well, let's hear a little bit more from Redemption. This is the song Surrender that has some of that language of recovery in it.
Every morning when I wake up, I surrender all of my fears, all my trials, tribulations. Higher power, take them away. As the day goes long, everything seems to go wrong. Surrender, and the battle's not yours. The fight's already been won. Yes, it has. Surrender,
the pain, no.
We're listening to the song Surrender. It's from the new CD Redemption by the New Orleans musician and bandleader Glenn David Andrews, who's our guest. Now, it's hard to explain to a New Hampshire audience what a New Orleans kind of freeform show sounds like, looks like. I've seen you get up on tables, walk around with the crowd. What is it about interacting with the crowd that makes a difference for you as a performer?
Well, I have ADD and I can't keep still. No, I feel the music. I just got to be honest with you. There's 4 or 5 times a week I perform, and there's 2 times a week, besides like right now doing an interview, when I really get to live my dream. And my dream is up on that stage with those lights shining on me. And for 3 hours, I get to pretend that I'm Louis Armstrong in 2014. Than all of the silver and gold. And I get to imagine that I'm a happy person, which I am, and I'm grateful to do what I'm doing. For those 3-4 hours, I might jump, I might shout, I might clap, because that's what I feel. I'm not doing that just so people can say, oh, wow, he got up on tables. You know, I'm 6'4". I got to be careful getting up on tables with that's wet. Crowd surfing at 200 pounds ain't easy, but when you feel it, you feel it, man, and I feel the music. It's like, I just enjoy what I do.
Well, you, besides carrying on in the tradition of Louis Armstrong, also Mahalia Jackson, even on this very record, you pick up from one of her songs, Didn't It Rain? Let's hear a bit from that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it rained 40 days, 40 nights without stopping. Noah was glad when the rain stopped dropping. Knocked on the window, knocked at the door. Cried, brother Noah, take some more. Noah cried, Noah, full of sin. God's got the key, can't get in. Just listen, how it's raining. Well, listen, how it's raining. All day, all night. Just listen, how it's raining. Some morning.
That's Glenn David Andrews singing in his very own way one of the traditional songs of Mahalia Jackson, the gospel great from New Orleans. You know, Glenn, I noticed that you're not playing trombone, which is one of the things you became known for on all the tracks, and in fact, very few of them. So is this a decision for you to be a singer first, to go in another direction?
I'm a 100% entertainer. You actually hit it right. I enjoy playing the horn. I actually play it a lot more now, but it's something, you know, I've got 20 years of playing the trombone. I just want to sing, and I want to entertain, and I want to play it when I feel it. I don't want to be pressured to play it.
I think listening to this record, a lot of us get reminded of this idea of, like, coming through the storm. I mean, I remember hearing this expression once, like, religious people are afraid of hell, but spiritual people have already been there. So you're carrying on in some kind of spirit. You kind of been through hell, and I wonder, if you hadn't, would you have made this record? Or what kind of record would you be making?
You know, the reality of that question is, if you don't get yourself together, you're not going to do really. You're not going to be successful in life. You know, the only thing to that is an Amy Winehouse ending, people like that that's really talented that never get it. You know, the Michael Jackson endings, the overdoses, the dying, the... That's the reality of that. No, I don't have time to sit around and pretend like that's not the reality of what would have happened. And in life, you have to go through your own personal storms. And my storms is not over. Right now, I'm just going through a good season. Maybe in a few years from now, I might have financial trouble. I might have health trouble. But when you're surrounded by people that love you and you really know, reach out and say, I need help, there's not really much you can't overcome. Like, I really believe that.
Glenn David Andrews, I want to thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Anytime, and hopefully we get to hang out in New Orleans. I could take you by Kermit and get some barbecue.
All right, I'm signing up for it now. Musician and bandleader Glenn David Andrews. You can listen to a few tracks from his new CD, Redemption, and read some of the glowing reviews, including from the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. Those links are at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for joining us today. Earlier in the show, we talked about a growing trend among thrill-seeking vacationers, war tourism. That's people traveling to war-torn countries to witness the conflict firsthand. It sparked an awful lot of debate among the word-of-mouth crew, and we'd love to put it to you. Does witnessing a conflict firsthand provide us with deeper insight into world affairs? Or is it just first-world voyeurism on steroids? You can weigh in on the debate on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. After all, the most passionate opinions are best shared by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on NHPR.
Walking down upon this faith,
oh, cherry.
I'm singing out loud to guide me. Give me your strength. Give me your strength.